On today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, we look into the role of the U.S. in Africa. The continent is still in the grip of neocolonialism, which is as repressive and exploitative as colonialism, just less visibly so.
On occasion, when these trucks have been going in, and now initially it was about 400 or so that had not returned, and the recent data is now over 800 trucks that had entered the Tigray region and were not returning back. Yet pressure by international organizations, again echoing this aspect of humanitarian assistance is not being allowed by Ethiopia, was louder, yet nobody is addressing the big elephant in the room that these trucks were going in and were not coming back out.
Belen Seyoum, foreign press secretary to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, on the 800 flatbed food aid trucks that disappeared into the country's Tigray region, on Western media slander of Ethiopia and on its enormous potential, nevertheless.
The U.S. has to have very difficult internal discussions politically in terms of its current position globally and its vision for itself. The U.S. now has to redefine their role politically and economically, and it's going to be hard to do so when you have a country like China that has a grand strategy, a global strategy.
Howard University African Studies Professor Anita Plummer on the U.S. and China in Africa.
AFRICOM has been a focus of our work. We've been connecting the AFRICOM work to the work that we've been involved in the U.S. around the Department of Defense 1033 program, which is a program being used by the U.S. government to militarize police forces across the country.
And Ajamu Baraka on AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. This and more on today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy from the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. First, the U.S. in Ethiopia, a conversation with Belen Seyoum, foreign press secretary to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Ethiopia has been engaged in a civil war since a treasonous ethnic minority army, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, commonly known as the TPLF, attacked one of its federal army bases on November 3, 2020. The TPLF claimed to represent a 6% minority population, but many members of the Tigrayan diaspora and some Tigrayans in government have said that they do not. The U.S. supported the TPLF politically, diplomatically, economically, and militarily throughout their 27-year tyrannical rule of the entire country from 1991 to 2018. In exchange, the TPLF put the Ethiopian army in service to the U.S. agenda on the African continent. In 2018, popular uprisings ousted the TPLF and put Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in power. And in 2020, Prime Minister Abiy was elected. Today we're speaking with Belen Seyoum, poet, feminist, and the Prime Minister's foreign press secretary. Belen Seyoum, thanks for speaking with Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. Especially since after that CNN interview last week, I wouldn't be surprised if you never wanted to speak to any U.S. press again.
And thank you so much for having me, and any opportunity for a constructive engagement is always welcome from our side, and I do not have any doubt that we will be having that kind of a conversation with you.
Would you mind if we nevertheless play just a bit of CNN aggression so our listeners will have an idea of what we're talking about?
Sure, let's go ahead.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you for joining us. A year since the start of Ethiopia's conflict, yet we are seeing armed groups fighting your government increasing its numbers as they advance towards the capital. What's happening on the ground and how far are the TPLF and other allies from Addis Ababa?
Becky, thank you so much for having me. Before I answer your question, it would be quite disingenuous of me to respond to your question without first addressing the big elephant in the room. And it's important for me to share with you as well as your global audience that Ethiopians, a majority of Ethiopians in Ethiopia as well as abroad, strongly feel that CNN has covered the conflict over the past year in a manner that is highly biased and detached from context. And a recent example is the hysteria that CNN had caused last week, as if Addis Ababa was under siege, sending a global message that the city is about to go down. And we have often shared that it seems Ethiopia is undergoing what seems like a coordinated media campaign to tarnish the image of the country, to tarnish the image of the prime minister and his administration. And media outlets like CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, and Reuters in particular, as well as others, have often chosen to carry an overly negative and skewed narrative, missing important nuances. And I reiterate this to you because I also heard the opening lines, which takes away or is devoid of assigning the actual blame where it is, assigning the blame to the TPLF that initiated this conflict. And they have also given testimony and confessed that they're the ones that attacked the Northern Command of the National Defense Forces.
Right.
So I think it's important.
Let me respond to your words, because I've given you a chance to say your bit. Our work, our reporting was conducted carefully and methodically by CNN's highly experienced team in the region and elsewhere. We stand by its findings as well as the language used in our reporting, which we believe is fully justified.
Now, just to put things colloquially for listeners who don't know much about this subject, CNN's Becky Anderson wanted to know when Ethiopia's government and its capital, Addis Ababa, would hurry up and finally fall to the U.S.-backed Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. That should have gotten a big fat F in Journalism 101, and CNN's been in the lead in slandering your country for the past year. But what do you think of the rest of the Western press coverage?
Thank you, Anne. At this moment, there is really no fun interview because predominantly over the past year, a lot of Western media have already framed the issue. And so you have a tendency for other follow-up media to also kind of dish out from the same bowl. But I don't want to make the mistake of lumping all Western media in the same bin, as there are a handful, and I would say a handful, that do try to get the context right. But predominant coverage, like I was saying, of mainstream Western media has been one-sided to the extent that it makes one believe that there is a concerted negative propaganda campaign against Ethiopia and the prime minister specifically. So now your listeners may be interested to know which are the common areas of negative campaigning and propaganda that I strongly feel has been dominating a lot of Western media. And there's a number of them, but to begin with, for example, there's this overarching narrative of the Nobel Peace Prize laureate gone rogue on peace.
Oh, yeah.
And this is such a damaging and patronizing narrative because it doesn't put into perspective, or it only starts highlighting what has happened within the country as of November 3rd when the TPLF attacked the Northern Command of the National Defense Forces. It doesn't put into perspective the lengths that the Prime Minister had gone over the past 3 years prior to the November 3rd attacks to engage in dialogue with the TPLF, to encourage their leadership to participate in the political spaces that are opening up. It doesn't put into perspective the efforts by the government as well to ensure that the platforms that were created were inclusive and onboarding them in that process as well. So the way that narrative has been skewed and the personification of everything on the prime minister is quite puzzling. The second one, in terms of misinformation that the Western media has been propagating, is, again, the personification that the prime minister attacked the Tigray region. Again, there's evidence and they're on record on the senior leadership of the Tigray People's Liberation Front saying that they have undertaken a preemptive attack. Granted that they said it in a language that is not in English, but there hasn't been any effort from international media, particularly Western media, to really dig into that. So a year on later into this altercation, you're still seeing that same narrative being perpetrated again and again and misinforming a global audience. The third one that I want to raise is this aspect of portraying the TPLF as a victim and not really understanding the true nature of the TPLF. I think for a majority of the world, the point in time in which they've started knowing who TPLF is as of November 3rd because of the way that it has been spinned. So nobody understands that the TPLF have been a small clique that have been ruling Ethiopia the 27 years preceding the prime minister coming to the premiership in 2018. And the nature of the way that they had been ruling Ethiopia, the divisive nature along ethnic cleavages, magnifying these divisions, the vast human rights abuses that are documented, the killing, the economic sabotage and the corruption that this group, when you look at where Ethiopia could have been if there was a strong and solid government that had been holding it for the past 7 years, it's really heartbreaking. So again, the way that international media is portraying TPLF as a victim of a federal government is a very erroneous and misleading agenda, and it's a betrayal to the people of Ethiopia who've been subjugated to the oppressive reign of TPLF. A fourth one that I want to bring up again alongside this is this aspect of the nation is disintegrating. So this alarmist narrative that you're seeing being spewed, particularly over the past 3 weeks, that this has been an incremental approach that has been utilized again in this concerted orchestration. So, the nation is disintegrating, dissuading investments, disencouraging people to come in and understand what the actual context is. And then the current alarmism that had been propagated by, as you had rightly pointed, CNN, saying that Addis Ababa is under siege, creating a sense of panic within the nation and the way that international audiences are looking at Ethiopia. A fifth element, and I'm wrapping up on this aspect, is again magnifying or pushing a TPLF narrative that ethnic cleansing, ethnic profiling, and genocide is taking place. Now, for anybody, for somebody who's been following a lot of these international media outlets before as key information outlets, it's very disheartening for me to see that international reporting and journalism is kind of at a threat because of the very sensational way that the Ethiopian conflict has been documented over the past year. And I say this because on November 3rd, bordering on November 4th, the TPLF attacked the Northern Command, a treasonous attack on the National Defense Forces. And this is a Northern Command that had been stationed within the Tigray region for 20 years, protecting the people of Tigray, supporting them, or supporting farming communities when farming time had come in, fighting desert locusts, doing a lot of things. So when they had attacked the Northern Command by that point in time, by November 4th, you would see that they were already their digital wing in the Western part of the world, predominantly in the US and in the UK, had already started trending a hashtag on social media, particularly on Twitter, declaring Tigray genocide. So at that point in time, they had struck the National Defense Forces within the Tigray region. The rest of the National Defense Forces were not even within the Tigray region. So you can see that this was orchestrated, and while the government was caught off guard, this narrative was already being developed. Now we have a lot of international media and respectable, or what used to be respectable and reputable international media and their senior anchors perpetuating this narrative of, genocide and ethnic cleansing that's happening in the country, which is absolutely untrue. And the recent UN report, Human Rights, together with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission that was undertaken, also ruled that out. So these things are not, told as much as they need to be, yet the propaganda is something that is being pushed. And then finally, again, the sixth element that I was telling you about is this aspect of Addis Ababa being under siege, that TPLF is battle-hardened, so they're going to take over. But this is the same narrative that was being used by international media, that was being used by TPLF and their allies when they were coming into the other parts of the country 30 years ago, when they were engaged in this kind of a battle with the previous regime, the Derga socialist regime as well. So it's like a playbook of what they had done the last time as well, which at that point in time, because there wasn't social media and there wasn't an active citizen journalist component to it, a lot of the propaganda had not been pushed back, but it was the same tactics that they were using, building up this image of strength and saying, we're going to take over Addis, when even at that point in time, 30 years ago, they were not even close to Addis. Yet they created so much panic that, the government became porous at that point in time. So they're using the same tactics again, and they have their helpers within international media and international spaces that are also fanning these flames of you know, Addis being under siege, the vicinity being under siege, and that it's a foregone conclusion that the TPLF are going to be entering. So the psychological warfare against Ethiopian Ethiopians is something that is being fanned again on international media spaces, issuing full statements from the government, also sharing full interviews that they have undertaken, because there's a lot of people that are being interviewed to give the information from the government side, and silencing of pro-Ethiopian voices as well on mainstream media spaces. So I really think that real credible media outlets and journalists who still believe in the ethics of journalism have a responsibility to expose this criminal enterprise and its allies for what they are.
I've got to say here that I have never thought CNN was respectable or responsible, but I know it's easier to see when it's coming at you with a vengeance like it is at Ethiopia. The good thing about this is that CNN is actually dying. More and more people are turning to web-based media, and most cable news is dying. Now, I want to ask you about the trucks, the 800-some trucks that have disappeared into Tigray and the narrative surrounding that.
Yeah, I mean, that that narrative is quite interesting because until June 2021, until the end of June, the Ethiopian government was the one that was taken on the burden or the responsibility. It has to be a responsibility from the government's end of providing humanitarian assistance to the people of Tigray. At that point in time, the humanitarian needs were obviously concentrated within the region. And so up to 70% was being provided by the government, and partner organizations were merely providing 30% of assistance, yet they occupied 70% of the space in terms of pushing for humanitarian assistance, saying nothing is being reached there. So in end of June 2021, the federal government enacted a humanitarian ceasefire, a unilateral humanitarian ceasefire, because the other side, quote-unquote, depicted this or portrayed this as a sick joke. That's what they referred to it as. Yet in Ethiopia, the rainy season begins around June and it goes on until September. So that is critical for farming communities, and particularly because the Tigray region, prior to the conflict starting, is a food insecure region. They've always been on food assistance because it's a very harsh environment. So the area in which farming communities would have to produce to ensure that, because the previous year as well, due to desert locusts, farming communities have been heavily affected. And with the conflict the following year, it was essential and part of government responsibility to ensure that the farmers within Tigray would have a break from what was happening and negatively affecting them so that they could go about their farming activities. Yet the National Defense Forces withdrew from the Tigray region, and what we witnessed rather is, instead of the TPLF taking this as a token of peace and ensuring that the people of Tigray, in whose name they say that they're standing up for, yet in whose name they're trading for their political agenda, instead of taking that, they rather mobilized citizens within the region to go and attack neighboring communities in the Afar region, which is neighboring, and also in the Amhara region. So at that point in time, with the potential of having gone into the second wave of humanitarian assistance and with more humanitarian actors getting engaged, the potential for them to enter into the Tigray region was being hampered, because for the propaganda machinery of TPLF, they wanted to portray that the government was not enabling humanitarian assistance and suffocating its people from food provisions for critical communities. So these tactics were employed at that point in time. But on occasion, when these trucks have been going in, and now initially it was about 400 or so that had not returned, and the recent data is now over 800 trucks that had entered the Tigray region and were not returning back. Yet the pressure by international organizations, again echoing this aspect of humanitarian assistance is not being allowed by Ethiopia, was louder, yet nobody is addressing the big elephant in the room, that these trucks were going in and were not coming back out. And at one point in time, the UN office in Ethiopia had issued a statement on social media saying that in order for humanitarian assistance, for their assistance to be effective within the region, the trucks needed to return, and that they were encountering this challenge of the trucks not returning as well. Now, on the TPLF side, you know, and what a lot of international media took up is that fuel, they were only fueled with enough to take them into the region but not come back out. And that was absolutely fabricated, because what we've seen in a lot of imagery and photographs and utilizing their own media spaces, what we've seen is that the trucks were being used to transport fighters outside from the Tigray region, taking them into the other regions in which that they were attacking. So the siphoning off of humanitarian assistance and humanitarian aid for fighters, you know, taking it away from the real beneficiaries who needed it, and also hijacking the trucks and the modes of transport that were supposed to enable humanitarian assistance to flow within the region was being hijacked by the TPLF for its own agenda. Encroachment and belligerence into other regions, to join the TPLF belligerence in other regions. So they're utilizing them to transport fighters.
China and Russia's English language press have encouraged Ethiopia and suggested that the U.S. back off. Could you say something about Ethiopia's collaborative relationships with China and Russia?
Well, you know, Ethiopia has long-standing, as an ancient country, Ethiopia has got long-standing relations with the various countries throughout the world. And in particular, it also has trade ties with China and Russia, in addition to other trade ties with other countries. As it pertains to China, China is one of Ethiopia's key development partners, with many productive investments by various Chinese businesses that are operating in various sectors. A key demonstration of that has been in infrastructure development as one key area of cooperation. And Ethiopia-China relations have also grown over the years in great leaps, and they've expanded in many fields, including the economy, politics, security, technology transfer, academia, and capacity building. And also, with Ethiopia being an active participant in the China's proposed Belt and Road Initiative, which is a global development plan that involves infrastructure development and trade and investment facilitation aimed at boosting connectivity on a transcontinental level, Ethiopia's cooperation with China has also improved the country's infrastructure and strengthened its industrial establishments in that regard. When you look at with Russia, as it pertains to Russia, similarly, the relations between the two countries are also quite historic. And Ethiopia acknowledges Russia as a key partner in our development endeavors. In terms of trade relations and businesses, the Russian Federation, for example, supplies Ethiopia with the mineral fertilizers, and Ethiopia a key or one of the key drivers of the economy being agriculture. Ethiopia has engaged in exports of agricultural products like coffee, oilseed, pulses, vegetables, and flowers. So with both of these countries, as well as with other countries, there is room for further enhanced trade ties.
That was Bilane Seyoum, Foreign Press Secretary to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Next, competition between the U.S. and China in Africa has been one of the central narratives about Africa since the outset of the Cold War. Howard University African Studies professor Anita Plummer discussed the subject with Walter Turner, College of Marin African Studies professor and host of KPFA's Africa Today.
Today, we're going to be talking about Sino-Africa, meaning relationship between the African continent, the African peoples, government, and China. And there's a bigger dialogue that's going on around China, which is not the focus of our conversation today. Where is that bigger dialogue coming from? Is it really a U.S. or imperial dialogue, if that's not the wrong word, from those countries who have had easier access to resource and markets? Or what's your thought on where that died? Because China has been in the news more. You hear presidents of the United States mention it more than ever before. Where's that coming from, Anita?
Well, the United States is in a situation where they have relied on their post-Cold War position in terms of exerting political, military, and economic influence globally. And there are shifts, there are very profound shifts happening in the international system now, where more and more nations, especially in the global south, Latin America, Asia, and Africa, are now looking at China as an alternative, right? Okay. China's economy is set to surpass the U.S. within the next 20 years, and that may actually be scaled back to 10 years, depending on how our economy continues to grow in comparison to China's. So the U.S. has to have very difficult, you know, internal discussions politically in terms of its current position globally and its vision for itself, right? So these shifts have challenged U.S. hegemony, and I think there is a lot of discomfort, and it's not new. It started with the Obama administration, that the U.S. now has to redefine their role politically and economically, and it's going to be hard to do so when you have a country like China that has a grand strategy, a global strategy, that is literally, you know, 50 years in the making. So wrestling with that in the current environment, political environment, has been difficult for U.S. policymakers, but the U.S.'s post-Cold War position has shifted, and the developing world, where local markets and governments are now recalibrating themselves away from the West and more toward China. And this is something that the U.S. has to contend with.
Thank you. You know, in your paper, which you developed on your work around Kenya, you started with some historical background connections between China, Asia. We might refer to them as the Swahili coast, the states of the Indian Ocean, and East Africa. Share with us some of that historical background with China and Africa before what we would call the modern era, I guess, is that fair to say?
Yeah, so there is a long, rich history, pre-modern history, between the East Coast of Africa and China, which is very significant because there's this general idea that Africa had no history prior to European interventions, prior to the transatlantic slave trade or colonialism. And this long history dates all the way back to the 9th century, where there was trade facilitated by Muslim traders between southern China all the way to present-day Somalia and Kenya. So this rich history is very powerful today because you find that Chinese diplomats evoke this history and say, listen, we're here as a non-paternalistic partner. We have historical ties with Africa just as Europe and the United States have historical ties with Africa. The major difference is we came based on mutuality and fair trade and cooperation. And this is, again, historically. Therefore, we have a legacy and a history as strong in Africa as the Western powers. So this rich history has currency in contemporary conversations on China and Kenya, or Africa in general.
And that's been your response in terms of your research work, that when you engage with, is it the energy that Chinese political and economic actors have put forth in Kenya? Is it something that resonates with people on the African continent?
So So that's where it becomes a bit sticky. It resonates among diplomats who, of course, are trying to frame contemporary relations as something that is historically based. However, the typical person, Kenyan, doesn't necessarily know about this history. However, if you would indulge me for a minute, there is a community of Chinese descendants living in a small coastal town in Kenya called Malindi. And there's a rich history between Malindi and China, in which at one point a giraffe from Malindi went to China, and this was 600 years ago, I'm talking. And as a result, that prompted the Chinese ruler to want to travel to Africa. He wanted to know, okay, where did this giraffe come from? So Zheng He was a Chinese voyager that had a series of trips from Southeast Asia to South Asia to the east coast of Africa. On one of those trips, Zheng He went to Malindi. And as I interviewed people on the east coast of Africa in Malindi to get this story. So there's a story that one of the Zheng He ships was shipwrecked, and they landed back in Malindi. And two Chinese sailors survived the shipwreck, and they went to the community, and they said, we want to be integrated into the community. And the community said, sure, you know, you can be integrated, but you have to prove yourself. So as the story goes, there were two pythons tormenting the community. The sailors had to fight off the pythons, and after they had done so, they were able to marry local women, and they were absorbed into the community. So again, this is 600 years ago. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to the early 2000s, and the Chinese government knew that this story had existed. So they went in and did DNA testing of a few families that said that they were descendants from these soldiers. And sure enough, the Chinese government said, look, you know, the DNA has proved that we have long lost ancestors in Africa. And so this is just one example of how rich the history is and how the history still has currency today in terms of solidifying the legitimacy of China in Kenya and in Africa. Because in speeches, diplomats talk about the descendants. They say, look, we have Chinese descendants in Africa. It makes sense that we're partners in the developmental processes. So that's just one example of a rich nugget of history that has not quite made it into mainstream histories, even within Africa.
Well, thank you for doing the research. All of this is at some point as we move forward into the post-World War II, into the Cold War period. All of this is part facilitated by the Silk Road. Tell us, for listeners who may not know, the Silk Roads, its role in trade between Asia and what we call Africa and Europe and the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, so the Silk Road there was an overland Silk Road that stretched from the east coast of Africa across eastern and then western Europe. And then there was an ocean Silk Road, which crossed from the Pacific side across the Indian Ocean around South Asia, West Asia, to the east coast of Africa. So 600 years ago, this history between Africa and China was facilitated through the maritime Silk Road. And today, the Silk Road has been evoked again with China's Belt and Road Initiative. So these very complex trade networks are an example of transnational globalization, transnational trade that happened without European intervention. So you have 600 years ago, civilizations that were engaged in these global trade networks that didn't have the imperial ambitions as what would come later with European imperialism and colonization. So again, this is another example of a different historical narrative in which you have people within the global South interacting with each other in terms of trade and finance today in the absence of Europe and facilitating this without European intervention.
Mm-hmm. How does the China-Africa relationship evolve after World War II and during the period of the Cold War, a period in which I think that Taiwan or Formosa is also recognized. China's relationships with the Soviet Union go through changes. Where does China-Africa interaction sit in that period, 1945, going up into the 1960s?
So China played an important role in helping Pan-African movements and nationalist movements seek liberation and independence from colonial powers.
That was Howard University African Studies Professor Anita Plummer speaking with College of Marin African Studies Professor and KPFA Africa Today host Walter Turner. The full version of this conversation is the November 15, 2021 Africa Today archive on the KPFA website, kpfa.org.
From the Congo to the Mississippi, I wanna see people living free. From the Congo to the Mississippi, Bomoy Malambo, Garabaton, your soul. I've heard it said, I've heard you telling me, be the change the world wanna see. But how such a simple truth could remain such a mystery? Lucibula Masita, Cosinga Montemuelo Solo. Tu vila cana, mami mantama, Matulundanga Mutima Mieto, Ebanca Lucibula Masita, Cosinga Montemuelo Solo.
That was Congo to the Mississippi by artists collaborating in Playing for Change. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Finally, Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report editor and co-founder and national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, spoke with Tia Coatley, producer and host at Pacifica affiliate WXOX Louisville.
Today, we're honored to have with us Ajamu Baraka, Black Agenda Report editor and columnist and co-founder and national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity. I am the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, a new organization that was born 4 years ago with the express mission to try to revive the traditional Black internationalism that's characterized our movement here in the U.S., and to keep a focus on the policies that we believe are imperialistic, militaristic, and anti-people being articulated and implemented by the U.S. government and the U.S. state.
Ajamu, what is AFRICOM, and when was it created, and why?
Well, you know, one of our first mission, first campaign was to focus on AFRICOM. AFRICOM is short for the U.S. Africa Command. The U.S. has divided the entire planet into 11 command structures where they are committed to maintain the U.S. dominance globally. So the command structure for Africa was created and launched October the 1st, 2008, a few months before Barack Obama assumed office. And we have been organizing to make people aware of AFRICOM, because we have seen that with the establishment of AFRICOM, we've seen a 1,900% increase in the footprint, if you will, of the U.S. military on the African continent. In every place that we've seen an increase in the U.S. military presence, we've also seen an uptick in violence. The U.S. claims that they are on the African continent to try to preempt violence, to preempt so-called terrorist activities. But instead, what we see is that wherever they seem to camp down, there is an increase in internal destabilization and violence. So, you know, we have been bringing people to the point of understanding that AFRICOM is not a benevolent organization, but is instead an instrument of U.S. control on the African continent. The main reason why they have been expanding their presence on the African continent is to put a brake on what they see as the influences coming from the Chinese. So AFRICOM has been a focus of our work, and we've been connecting the AFRICOM work to the work that we've been involved in the U.S. around the Department of Defense 1033 program, which is a program being used by the U.S. government to militarize police forces across the country. So we're connecting the two, the militarization of police forces domestically and the militarization of the African continent abroad.
As we know, Ajamu, U.S. presence in Africa is nothing new. Most people know that the U.S. and Belgium arranged the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 1961, crushing that nation's self-determination to this day. That's a crime that both governments finally acknowledge in just this century. What has this expansion of U.S. presence meant for the sovereignty of U.S. nations?
It's a very good question, and as we indicated in the first response, we have seen that the sovereignty of African states have been challenged by the presence of AFRICOM, because when various states go into enter into an agreement with AFRICOM, U.S. Africa Command, they have to give up certain things. For example, if bases are established in their countries, they have no, the government has no real jurisdiction any longer over the airspace and the land where those bases might be established. We know that as a consequence of increased U.S. Training of police forces and the military in those countries, that those forces are sometimes used against the people of those countries who are opposed to the U.S. being there. So the result has been a certain degree of destabilization. So the kind of intrigue that we saw when they had Patrice Lumumba murdered has increased, has continued throughout the decades, and in fact intensified. Your listeners must be reminded of the intrigue that led to the destruction of the most prosperous nation on the African continent in 2011. That country was Libya, under Muammar Gaddafi. And today, the fastest growing economy on the African continent, Ethiopia, is now gripped in a civil war, if you will, that many people believe has been instigated and supported by the U.S. government. So sovereignty, national sovereignty, has been a challenge, and the integrity and the dignity of African people have been the victims of the expansion of the U.S. military presence on the African continent.
Can you explain AFRICOM's role in promoting neocolonialism in Africa?
AFRICOM supports neocolonialism because AFRICOM has to enter into a relationship with the governments of these various countries. And there is sort of a win-win relationship in those agreements. That is, the U.S. is able to advance its interests on the African continent, and the elite, the neocolonial elites in these states feel protected by having that kind of relationship with the U.S. And so in many ways, AFRICOM undermines the democratic instincts and democratic push of the African masses who want to have authentic democracy in their countries. Instead, they end up being subjected to autocratic rulers supported by the U.S. through AFRICOM.
Where do you see resistance to AFRICOM on the continent and in the rest of the world?
Well, on the African continent, we see that there's resistance in various states to AFRICOM. There was resistance in Libya. There was resistance in places like Mozambique and in Kenya. There's popular resistance in Ghana. There's been popular resistance across the African continent because the more mature political forces understand what it means when their governments enter into a relationship with the U.S. By allowing the U.S. to enter into their national territories. The resistance is also coming from our forces in the U.S. Again, one of our major campaigns is to bring attention to the existence of AFRICOM and to build opposition to it. We are calling on, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus and the U.S. Congress to launch an investigation to look at the impact of AFRICOM on the African continent with the intent that eventually they will call for Africa to be demilitarized, that is, to shut down AFRICOM. There's also resistance coming from various forces in Europe and throughout Latin America and Asia, because we want to see the entire planet demilitarized. And that means shutting down these aggressive U.S. command structures.
You know, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, where they use militarized performance against a neighborhood full of black people, which led to the murder of David McAtee on my birthday, by the way, and the place where the Louisville police killed Breonna Taylor, which was pretty much the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020. With that in mind, do you think that resistant AFRICOM could become part of the movements to end police brutality, mass incarceration, and other forms of racist oppression and exploitation?
They have to be, because they're interrelated. That the militarization of the U.S. police forces has resulted in a more aggressive police force. The wars that have been initiated by the U.S. abroad has resulted in personnel in those police forces being more aggressive, because one of the prime areas of recruitment for the police has been the military. So veterans make up large numbers of the police forces across the country, and they have brought those same kinds of insurgent mentalities where the people who they were fighting in Afghanistan or in Iraq or on the African continent, they are the insurgents. They are the enemies. And that's been fueled also by racist ideals. So they bring those same kinds of attitudes to policing domestically. So they're interconnected. And we say that if one wants to understand why your communities are being overly policed, you have to also understand why communities around the world of people of color are being over-policed. In the U.S., in our case, it is the domestic army that we call the police. Abroad, it is the army that we recognize as the army. But both are representing the same objective interest, the interest of white power, the interest of capitalism. And so we have to recognize we have one system that's responsible for our suffering, and that there's no prioritizing just what we are doing in the U.S., without understanding how U.S. policies are impacting people around the world and building relationships of resistance with our friends and allies around the world.
Now, as you know, more than 14% of the U.S. population is black, and roughly 60% of us live in the South, you know, which were the slave states, the states of the Confederacy. Do you think that we actually have the potential to organize against AFRICOM within our anti-racist movements?
Most definitely. And that land base that you referred to in your question is very, very important, because it is that land base that we have to try to cultivate to build our own independent political structures. It is from those independent political structures that we are able to connect up with political structures on the African continent who are involved in resistance against the U.S. state and NATO that's attempting to maintain their controls on the African continent. So again, these these struggles that might seem disconnected are in fact connected. They're part of one fight. And so for the U.S., we have to consolidate ourselves on our own land base and to deepen the levels of political organization to not only protect our people domestically, but also to be able to be in solidarity with our people on the African continent and throughout the Africa world, but also with everyone who's involved in an anti-colonial struggle. So yes, we can do it, and we can in fact win. No question about that.
Well, Black Alliance for Peace is definitely putting in the work to bring the awareness to AFRICOM. And what can we do as a people to help you and to help us in this situation?
We need to get organized, my friends. We say that if you want more information, please go to the blackalliancefor peace.com. We cover issues from the U.S. To throughout the world. Please consider, if you are of Black descent, to join the Black Alliance for Peace. If you happen to not be Black, that's all right too. We have a BAP solidarity network that you can join and help to build anti-war and an anti-imperialist movement here in this country. So yes, we have to get organized. If BAP is not your cup of tea, join some other organization that's fighting for the masses of your people, of our people. But that's the only way we're going to be able to survive and to thrive, is through independent political organization.
Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for your time. Let us know where we can find you on the internet, on social media.
Please, you can follow me on Twitter at Ajamu Baraka. But more so, more importantly, instead of me as an individual, please follow the Black Alliance for Peace and get involved. This information is important, and we've got to be connected to one another, because the only way we're going to be able to win is when we're able to concentrate our power.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking with WXOX Louisville host Tia Coatley.
Africa unites. Come on, Africa. Time to unite. Unite for the rights of people. You know. Africa, unite. Cause we're moving right out of Babylon. Yes, and we're grooving to our father's land. Oh, good and all, let the dick will be before God and man, to see the unification of all Rasta man. As it's been said already, let it be done. Come on, we are the children of God, Rasta man. We are the children of God. I am one. So now, Africa, unite. Africa, unite. Unite for the benefit of all people. Cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're grooving to our father's hand. Oh, good and a blessing it would be before God and man, to see the unification of all Africans. Marcus Garvey said it, so let it be done. I know you know who you are, under the sun. We are the children of the Rasta man. We are the children of the Rasta man. Africa, unite. Africa, unite. Unite for the benefit of your people.
That was Africa Unite by Bob Marley. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. This show was produced by me, Ann Garrison, with editing by Polina Vasiliev. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. Thanks for listening.